Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. I'm Jamie Dodd, Thomas Trance here as well. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And now joining us here on Canucks Talk, he covers the Canucks for Vancouver is Awesome. You probably follow him on Twitter at Passatabulas. He is also the writer of a new book, On the Clock, Behind the Scenes with the Vancouver Canucks at the NHL Draft. He is Daniel Wagner. Daniel, thank you very much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. And I do want to talk about the book and just kind of, you know, stories, putting it together, all of that in a little bit. But I know you've also recently been writing about one of the hot topics for the Canucks this offseason, which is, of course, restricted free agent Philip Hronek and what the Canucks should do with him. And, you know, Drance and I have disagreed with it a little bit. He made a bit of a harebrained Simon and Garfunkel analogy last week about it. But his basic stance is, who cares if Hronek can't drive a pair on his own? He's so good with Quinn Hughes that it doesn't matter. Pay the man his money. Do you agree or disagree with Drance's take on that?
After quite a bit of arguing with Drance myself, I've come around to his point of view to a certain extent. For me, it's less that Hronek can't drive a pairing on his own and more that we don't know whether he can or not. Based on last season, we never got a chance really to see if he could drive a pair, at least not over any extended period of time. Like, he played with Quinn Hughes the entire season. There were only 6 games all season that he spent less than 10 minutes with Hughes at 5-on-5. Like, he played with Hughes every single game.
I guess the concern for me is, because I take your point, right? We just don't have the enough information there. But I guess another way to phrase it would be, do you think he's a legit top pair defenseman? And I mean, independent from Quinn Hughes, on a Stanley Cup contending team, because I think that's what the Canucks ultimately need, right? Like, I think you look at the depth other than Edmonton, I guess, although Ekholm's is a really, really good defenseman, but it just feels like they need that other really high end defenseman. And if Hronek isn't that, it feels like an awful lot to be going, you know, 8 years and $7 million plus on a player who you don't think quite fits that role.
Well, it's an interesting way to phrase it. Like, is he a top pairing defenseman apart from Quinn Hughes on a Stanley Cup contender? Well, no, because without Quinn Hughes, the Canucks are not a Stanley Cup contender, period. End of story. I think what the Canucks need is to have someone with Quinn Hughes who can help him drive play. And I think that's the biggest area where Hronek helps him. A lot of the defensemen that they've tried to pair him with the past have been those defensive defensemen, those players who, you know, the idea is they're the stay-at-home defensemen so Quinn Hughes can freewheel and just do what he does. But that's not really what Hughes needs. It's the same thing that happened with the Sedins when they kept going, oh, we need a big power forward to make room for them. No, they didn't need a big power forward. They needed a smart, scrappy guy like Alex Burrows to retrieve the puck on the forecheck and go to the front of the net to put pucks in. They didn't need that big power forward. In the same sense, Quinn Hughes doesn't need that big stay-at-home defensive defenseman. He needs someone who can move the puck with him, whether that's breaking the puck out of the defensive zone or keeping the puck in the offensive zone and creating opportunities for him to make a difference. And I think that's the big area where Hronek helps. Now, is that enough to make the Canucks a Stanley Cup contender? Well, no, I think they need more defensive depth. They need a better top four defense. But you've got Hronek, a right shot defenseman who can play 23 plus minutes per night. You don't find those players apart from drafting them and developing them yourself. The Canucks haven't done that. They don't have that coming in the next couple of years, most likely. So yeah, you need Hronek if you want to be a contender, if you want to be pushing to make the playoffs and to go far in the playoffs. You need Hronek because you can't replace him.
Yeah, I think the other thing is the club probably does need another top pair defenseman, but that doesn't mean he has to be Hughes's partner, right? Like the help that they need on the second pair is probably higher than like a 3-4 guy. They probably need another difference maker. That would be sort of my response, right?
Like if you need another difference maker, why are you giving a long-term contract to a guy who's not going to be that difference maker for you? Like that, like I agree with you. They need another difference maker on a different pair.
Well, cuz whether they give if they don't give him the money and trade him, then they need two.
Yeah. It's true. You're not wrong.
Anyway,
I mean the big issue though, like you're talking about, it's not just whether to re-sign Hronek. In a vacuum, obviously you re-sign Hronek. The big issue is, do you re-sign Hronek for $8 million?
Yeah.
And that's where the sticking point is. It's not just whether you want Hronek or not. It's whether you want Hronek or spending that money in a different way, plus whatever assets you might get for him in a trade, all those other things that come into play. The issue is, like, the arbitration case that Hronek has is rock solid. So if Hronek decides he doesn't like what the Canucks are offering him, he thinks he can get more, he can file for arbitration and probably get what he's asking for, because there are just too many things in his favor based on what you can use in arbitration. And that arbitration case itself is probably a poison pill for any potential trade. Any team that could or would trade for Hronek has to consider that, okay, this guy's going to have an arbitration case that means maybe he gets around $8 million on a 1 or 2 year deal and goes straight to unrestricted free agency. And so any team that would trade for him has to have that in mind. And the Canucks probably don't get the value that they want in a trade if they did decide to trade him.
Mm. Right. And so how does the Hronek context in your views just sort of fit into the wider challenge of, you know, who stays, who goes, and how does this team get better from here?
I mean, it's a really tough conversation because you've got so many free agents on the blue line. The Canucks just have three NHL defensemen signed for next season, and one of them is Noah Juulsen, who is borderline NHL, let's be honest. As much as he improved last year, he took big steps forward, became somewhat reliable in a 6-7 role. You know, he's still borderline on a cup contender. And so you've got a lot of decisions to make. Zadorov, as good as his playoffs were, he wasn't actually that good in the regular season. If we're looking really honestly and taking an objective standpoint, as much as I love him as a talker, he had a great playoffs. His regular season just wasn't that impressive. You've got Tyler Myers, who people suddenly love again, after, you know, several years of him being kind of the scapegoat, kind of the guy that you look at as the problem. And now people want him back. But does that actually, bringing him back, bringing Zadorov back, does that actually make the team better? I don't know. But if you want to improve on those players, that's a major challenge.
So I just want to ask you one, because you've been in the weeds on Quinn Hughes' wowies over the course of the past week, and we'll get to the draft book and we'll get to Canucks prospects and a variety of other things over the balance of this interview. But I'm curious to get your take on this, having looked at this the way you have. Tyler Myers with Quinn Hughes has been something we've only ever actually seen situationally, and yet it's always worked. Like, he's always actually had a pretty significant impact on Hughes. I do believe there's score effects noise. And I know it's been conventional wisdom that, like, Myers isn't reliable enough defensively maybe to complement Hughes, but should we just take that as dogma? Is that not something worth seeing?
It's a really interesting question. It's something that I've been thinking about quite a bit, because it's hard to ignore how good their numbers are together. Now, right, like you say, there is some score effects issues. They're mainly putting them together when they're down by one or two and they need a goal. And it's not even necessarily that Hughes is changing defense partners and playing with Myers. It's mainly Hughes getting double shifted and playing with whoever they've got. And that means he's playing both with Hronek and Myers to get him out on the ice as much as possible. and they're mainly being used in offensive zone situations. You're not putting Hughes and Myers out on the ice when the team is about to spend some time in the defensive zone. So there's definitely a lot of situational effects there. The issue for me is that you need Hughes playing 23, 24 minutes per game, sometimes more. And if you're sending out Myers as his regular partner, do you trust Tyler Myers to play 22 minutes per game? Do you trust him to be playing those minutes? Because as much as he improved defensively, he's still going to be in the defensive zone a lot if he's playing with Hughes, and he's going to be playing against top competition, the first lines of other teams. I don't know that I trust Tyler Myers that much.
Yeah, and of course, a big part of his improved play, not just the system around him, but also being in the right role, right? And all of a sudden, if you're being jumped up to the first pairing to play with Quinn Hughes, you're being asked to do an awful lot, not just in terms of the minutes, but who you're matching up with, and that can be pretty tough to sustain for Tyler Myers. Okay, so, I mean, normally at this time of year, we would be like all absolutely, you know, deep diving on the draft and wondering who the Canucks are going to take and following the combine and all of that. And a little different this year, right? Because the Canucks don't pick to the third round. But we wanted to get in to your new book. As I said, it's called On the Clock, Vancouver with the Vancouver Canucks, Behind the Scenes with the Vancouver Canucks at the NHL Draft. And so just kind of a history of the Canucks NHL draft experience. As our listeners know, you know, there's been some big hits, there's been some big misses as well. Just tell us a little bit about the process of putting the book together.
Absolutely. I mean, it took about 9 months of writing for the first draft and putting it all together. There's a lot of interviews involved, whether it was talking to agents behind the scenes, scouts behind the scenes, some of whom did not want to have their names involved in the book, I will say that, but they definitely pointed me in the right direction. And I talked to some interesting people too. I talked to David Poile, whose father, Bud Poile, was the first general manager of the Canucks. And David Poile was actually there at the very first draft. He was at the Canucks table when the infamous wheel was spun. So it was kind of neat to get his firsthand experience of seeing that and the reaction from his father. And I talked to a number of the players as well. I had a really great conversation with Alex Edler about his experience getting drafted. And that was a really great conversation. So it was really neat to just really delve into this, go back into newspaper archives and see what people were saying at the time about the Canucks' somewhat sordid draft history. And it was a great experience writing it, actually. I really enjoyed it.
Is there a story that you learned about or maybe just learned more about through the course of putting the book together that kind of stands out as, you know, something that it's not front of mind when we think about the Canucks at the draft, but something really entertaining that stood out to you?
I mean, almost every single story that I came across, there was some aspect of it that I didn't know or wasn't aware of, and that kind of caught me off guard. I think the Pavel Bure story, a lot of people know the story, but the things that I found out, I had never heard before. They had never really been recorded in writing before. So that was a really interesting experience, kind of maybe breaking the myth. There's this legend of how Pavel Bure was drafted that some of it I found just wasn't true. And that was really a fascinating experience going like, okay, how much of this myth-making that we've heard about drafting Pavel Bure or drafting the Sedins, drafting, Trevor Linden, all of these myths and legends, how much of it was true? How much of it is just, you know, people talking up a good draft pick after the fact? Maybe the myth-making of someone like Brian Burke who loves to talk and pontificate about his great successes. And some of the interesting aspects of it too were with the Sedin draft. Yeah, Burke deserves all that credit that he claims. He deserves exactly as much credit as he claims. The more I looked into it, the more credit he deserved, which is, you know, maybe a little unexpected with someone who talks such a big game as Brian Burke.
What's your favorite myth punctured among those that you listed? What was the most interesting one to you, the one that had your eyes lighting up as you got to the bottom of it?
I have to say it's the Pavel Bure story. There's a story of Mike Penny.
Wags, let me interrupt you.
Okay.
Just let me ask you, set up the story for those of our audience who might be young enough that they don't know, like, the whole, like, sixth round, took a year to get it confirmed background of what occurred, and then I'm very curious to hear the rest of it.
Okay. And I won't tell the whole story because you have to buy the book.
Yeah, don't give it away for free.
But I will say this. One of the things that caught me off guard was, like, everyone kind of knows that Pavel Bure was drafted way later than he should have been. You know, we're talking sixth round. What business does he have getting picked there? And the number one reason for that is because of the Iron Curtain. You know, they were worried about getting players out of Russia at that time. And here's the thing about Pavel Bure. Any team could have drafted him in the first three rounds. That's how the NHL draft rules worked for players at that time. Any 18-year-old coming out of a European league could be drafted in the first three rounds. And every team knew that. Every team knew that Pavel Bure was eligible to be drafted. All they had to do was use a pick in the first three rounds, and they would have Pavel Bure. None of them picked Pavel Bure in the first three rounds, even though they all agreed he was arguably the best player in the draft. None of them were willing to even spend a third-round pick to get him. To me, that is pure cowardice. Like, they could have had Pavel Bure. Instead, they picked players, many of whom never even played in the NHL. So If Pavel Bure never even came out of Russia, never played for them in the NHL, nothing would have changed for them because they didn't pick an NHL player in the third round anyways. But none of them were willing to do it. There was that much fear about taking a player that they couldn't get out of Russia. And that, to me, I had heard about that before, but just really reading it and finding out all these NHL teams thought that Pavel Bure was the best player in the draft, and none of them were willing to even take a chance with a third round pick. That's wild to me. Now, the other issue then we get into, why does he last until the sixth round? Well, the rules surrounding the draft at that time were that if a player who is 18 out of Europe was going to get picked outside of the first three rounds, you had to fit certain criteria. You had to have played in a major European league for a certain number of games. And you had to play in those certain number of games across two seasons. Pavel Bure had completed that for one season, but not two. And so everyone thought Pavel Bure is not eligible to be drafted outside of the first three rounds. Now, the myth around this for the Canucks surrounds Mike Penny, who was a scout for them at the time, a lovely man. I had a long, long conversation with him because he was with the Canucks for decades and had all sorts of fantastic stories about the draft and the players that he scouted and that the team picked. But some of the myth around him is this Christmas game in Finland that he went to. This was a game between Russia, the Soviet Union, and Finland, a national, international game between these two teams, sanctioned by the IIHF, the IIHF. And so he went to this game on Christmas, drove through the snow. He was the only scout there that he knew about, that he could see. And he saw Pavel Bure at that game. And so in his mind, that game was one of the games that meant he was eligible to be drafted. That was one of the 11 games. He had to have played 11 games in two different seasons. And so Mike Penny told the Canucks, I know he's played enough games. I saw him. I was one of the only scouts there. I have the game sheet from that game. And that was what he used to convince Pat Quinn to draft Pavel Bure, was that he had seen him. He had the knowledge that no one else had, that Pavel Bure was eligible to be drafted because of these international games. And that's kind of the story that's been told ever since that draft, is that the Canucks had this secret knowledge about these international games that Pavel Bure played that made him eligible. And what I found when I really researched this and interviewed people and looked into it, that isn't true. That wasn't what made him eligible.
Yeah.
Those international games that Pavel Bure played had no relevance whatsoever to him being eligible to be drafted that year.
That's wild. And as you said, the team's passing on him in the first three rounds and, you know, picking a lot of guys that would not go on to play in the NHL, including the Canucks, right? They're picking eighth overall. Jason Herter played one game in the NHL in his career. So they were striking out at the top of that draft as well. And, you know, just before we let you go, Daniel, like, that's kind of the flip side of this. And I know, you know, I'm sure a lot of the book is focused on the successes in the NHL draft for the Canucks and the guys who went on to have great NHL careers. But I also know, knowing Canucks fans, they all have that one that got away that really looms large for them. In the course of kind of researching and talking to people, was there a bad pick that, like, even stands out to you even more now than maybe it did before you started getting into doing the book?
There were so many. That's part of the problem. There were just way too many. I will say, hey, Jason Herter, he was a point per game player in the NHL.
Yeah,
I will say that.
That's right.
But he just only played one game. You know, that's not his fault, or maybe it is. I don't know.
Why didn't he get another chance? Man, comes up, yeah, has a point.
Give him another game.
He's a defenseman.
You know, he probably could have scored more. There was just too many. Like, part of the real issue is that when the Canucks even picked a good player, like they got Rick Vive and Bill Derlago, who were really good players, Cam Neely, of course, they traded them away before they could actually be good enough to contribute. That was part of the infuriating thing when I was researching this and looking into it. There's a whole chapter on Rick Vive and Bill Derlago and Cam Neely and just how the Canucks had these good players and then traded them away. But I think one that really stands out is not necessarily even a bad player, just a bad pick. And that was Dennis Vevergaard in 1973. Dennis Vevergaard, pretty good player for the Canucks. You know, he played 583 games in the NHL. He was picked third overall in the 1973 draft, one pick ahead of Lanny McDonald.
Yeah, that's a tough one. That might have made a big difference for a young expansion Vancouver Canucks team. Daniel, really appreciate the time. The book sounds fantastic. Again, the book is On the Clock, Behind the Scenes with the Vancouver Canucks at the NHL Draft, and it's available everywhere now, correct?
That is correct.
All right. That's awesome. I encourage our listeners to check it out. And thank you very much for doing this.
I've read it, by the way. It's really good. Wags rocks.
Thank you, Dran. Thank you.
Thanks for doing this, man. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day, guys.
That is Daniel Wagner, of course. You can follow him on Twitter at @PassItToBoulos. He covers the Canucks for Vancouver, is awesome. And as mentioned again, the book On the Clock, Behind the Scenes with the Vancouver Canucks at the NHL Draft. I have not had a chance to check it out, but no shortage of wild stories. And, you know, just the Pavel Bure one by itself is absolutely fascinating. And you go through the list of all the interesting tales from the draft and the Vancouver Canucks. So shout out to Daniel Wagner for joining us to give us a little preview of that. All right, we will take a break. We got one final segment of the show here today. I want to dip a little bit back into the conversation we were having off the top of the show about the Canucks young players and what they can feasibly offer to the team next year, and how important is it that some of those young players really step up and become meaningful contributors. We will do that. You can text in as well, 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. Final segment coming up here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650 with Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz here. We're live from the Kintech Studio, 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at dunbarlumber.com. All right, earlier on in the show, in fact, to start the show, we were talking a little bit about how some of the Canucks prospects and young players might figure into the NHL picture next year, might or might not figure in to the NHL picture. And this is piggybacking off a piece Drantz has up at The Athletic right now looking at this same topic. And, you know, we talked a lot about Vasily Podkolzin, who, as I said, kind of the obvious choice to slide into an open forward spot, especially if Sam Lafferty's not back. You can kind of see a pretty direct one-to-one replacement there. We talked a little bit about Jonathan Lekaramäki as well, who has the high upside case, even though I think it's pretty unlikely that he ends up really factoring in a meaningful way for the Canucks at the NHL level next year. But, you know, there's a lot of other players who were with Abbotsford this year, some of whom got NHL time. Obviously, I'm thinking about Arshdeep Bains, who are at least going to be in the mix for spots on this NHL roster next year. Is there another guy who stands out to you? I mean, I guess we can, I almost put Archer Shelovs in a separate category as well, because it feels like a pretty much a lock that he's going to be the backup goalie. But is there another kind of dark horse or, you know, in that tier below Podkolzin guy who stands out as a potential contributor to the Canucks for you next year?
It's a tough one to answer. You know, like, I would have probably said Elias Pettersson, just in terms of the way that he made an instant impact at the American League level. But the fact that he wasn't a regular in the playoffs, I think suggests that he may be the sort of guy that needs seasoning. And most like Chris Tanev, after the 10-11 playoffs, went back down to the American League for half a season. And it couldn't have been clearer that he was an NHL level player.
Yeah.
Right. Like there are the defensive type defenseman. Like that's a skill set that takes some time to hone, especially when you're, you know, moving from the international ice surface to the North American one. But there are elements of his game, maturity-wise, that I think are interesting and relatively rare. Like the game within a game understanding that he showed right off the hop. You know, I know that that caught the Canucks' eye. I know that's something the Canucks are going to need, right? And yet, you know, if he was a righty, I'd be a little more interested in picking him. I think I'll go Atu Ratu, right?
Yep.
Because there is a certain power to draft capital, right? Like there is a certain element to which, you know, moving to the wing late in the year and going on a tear the way Ratu did, you know, that kind of positions you to, if you have a good summer, if you come into camp, right? And now you're in your third NHL training camp, you've kind of been through the rigors, you've already been traded, you've adapted to life in the American League, you found success late in the year. Can you build on that after a good summer and start to kind of deliver on some of your potential? Because at the end of the day, you know, I think like going into training camp, we'll probably be looking at like Arshdeep Bains, for example, having like an inside track over Ratu. But, you know, given their relative ages, given Ratu's draft capital, the pedigree that he's, you know, really held as a prospect since he was 15.
Yep.
You know, there's a world where, you know, he grows up, he levels up as a player quickly and becomes like a real option. And again, I think there's massive opportunity potentially on the wings for this team coming into camp. Like it's hard for me to not pick a winger below the Podkolzin level just because, you know, I don't exactly know what things are going to look like for the Canucks. I know there's going to be stiffer competition than is currently than it currently looks like if you just assume all the UFAs leave. But you know, Ratu's a guy who I think, given his scoring rates in the American League, given the way he concluded the season last year, I think we look at as having meaningful top nine potential still. We should anyway. And so he would sort of be one of the standouts to me as like having an upside case where he could be a meaningful contributor for the Canucks, if not next season, then down the line, if he can continue on this trajectory.
Well, and I think there's a size element there too, right? Not that that's his calling card as a player, but he is 6'2". And, you know, this is a team that we know really prioritizes size. And if they do end up losing Dakota Joshua, and we have no idea if that's going to be the case yet, right? There's still a lot of ground to cover between now and July 1st and him potentially signing with another team. But if they do lose Dakota Joshua, you know they're going to be eager to replace some of that size in the lineup. Again, you're not asking Atu Ratu to come in and replicate what Dakota Joshua did in terms of the physicality and the impact in that on that aspect of the game. But I think it absolutely will serve him well as if he trying to make this team at a training camp. And I think the shift to the wing is a big deal for him as well, right? Like, it would be a lot to ask, again, for a team who's raising expectations, who's raising the bar on what they want to do. I don't think you could ask Atu Ratu to come in and be like, hey, you're going to be our third line center. That's just way too high a bar to clear in a rookie NHL campaign. But contribute on the wings, on the third line, I think is a much, much more simpler path to him actually being an NHL fixture.
Yeah. I guess too, it's like who could beat out Pod Colson?
Yep.
Right. And I think you do have to think about Baines in there too, but I feel like Baines is less of a dark horse than Ratu, which is why I picked him. The point being that, between those three guys, there could end up, depending on how things shake out over the next month, you could end up in a pretty interesting three-way battle for a couple of spots, one replacing Joshua, one replacing Lafferty. And that logic could hold even if the Canucks are able to land, a high-end wing as a free agent.
Yeah, and, Baines, I am curious, right, because he showed well in parts in his NHL games this year, but I also thought that it looked like the kind of physicality, not just in terms of strength, but the strength-speed combination that he needed to take a step up in that regard. And so then you're looking at, Pod Colson, does he have a leg up there? Does Ratu have a leg up there as well? Not that Baines can't make it, but that's just something that stood out watching him last year for me. We have some people texting in, one about Linus Karlsson, correctly pointing out that Rick Tocchet seems to really like the guy and played him in big games in the playoffs this year. Is he somebody who could find a bigger role in the team next year? And we also have somebody texting in about Max Sasson, college UFA from last year, I believe, who came and played his first full year with the Abbotsford Canucks this year, plays down the middle. Karlsson obviously already has the NHL games, so I agree, but there's certainly a chance He breaks camp with the team and plays a role, given that Tocchet does like him. But both interesting names in terms of the young players for the Canucks at the depth options next year.
Yeah, the thing to watch for, though, with Karlsson is he's a restricted free agent, and because of his age, he's 24, he's actually arbitration eligible, which makes him a pretty strong non-tender candidate. Given that he played in the playoffs, given his American League production, not likely, but is there a world where if you end up in arbitration with him, there's some examples Anton Forsberg, the goaltender, if you go look at his cap friendly page, you'll see a kind of out of nowhere one way contract that he got awarded. One of those 1.5s, that teams are scared of, right? Teams worry about stuff like that. I don't think Karlsson has an overwhelming profile from sort of a risk mitigation standpoint, but at the very least, if you're keeping Karlsson, it requires some attention. It requires some administrative dexterity above and beyond that, which might end up being worthwhile for a 13th forward or, another guy to throw on the fire is a Baines, Ratu, Pod Colson candidate. So that's sort of why I didn't include him, is that I kind of view him as among the, not as high priority as Lindholm, Zadorov, Myers and company, but
no.
I sort of view him as one of the pending free agents that the club's, going to have an interesting little tap dance to do with the player. Shelovs is also out of contract, but he's different because he doesn't have arbitration rights, and this is relatively straightforward. It's you either give him a slightly higher AAV for a little bit of term, or you grind him and it's 1 year on a one-way deal. Karlsson's a little more complicated. If you're going to keep him on one of those, one-way deals for the league minimum, that's probably going to have to be done in advance, which does require just some work and some hand-holding and some management. The Canucks, I'm sure, don't have that as a front burner topic right now, given all the balls
that
are up in
the air. No, they've got a lot going on.
Nope. This offseason. I have heard that certainly Karlsson has fielded some offers for Europe, although he'd prefer to go back to Europe, although he'd prefer to stay with this organization. So we'll see where that one goes. But until he signed, I didn't want to include him as a consideration because, at the moment anyway, He's not like a clean, internal, completely cost-controlled player that the club doesn't have to worry about over the next 4 weeks. They don't have to, like, worry a lot. I'm not trying to do, like, a will Jordan Subban sign or not sort of scare tactics thing. But it's just one of those things that is actually going to require, you know, an afternoon's worth of work and hand-holding and relationship management to put him into the conversation even.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, right? And again, he was certainly not on my radar as like a contract that needed to be solved one way or another. I do think, again, given the need for depth, given that Rick Tocchet seems to like the player at least a certain degree, that there's a path to him coming back and figuring into the conversation. But it's a fair point,
yes,
right?
Agreed.
That there might be more straightforward options for the Canucks kind of at that level. What's your read on Max Sasson? I mean, again, total dark horse, I would think, to figure in at the NHL level. But just in general, his kind of trajectory, my understanding was that he impressed a lot of people at Abbotsford this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty interesting. Like, he's not that old for a second-year pro who was signed out of college. And, you know, 42 points in 58 games as a natural centerman with plus speed, you know, that's pretty good. Is it, you know, oh, man, the Canucks have the next Carter Verhaeghe or Jonathan Marchessault in their system? It's not. But that's okay because Sasson's game is well-rounded enough that I think you can look at him as a guy who could project to play bottom six or, you know, even fourth line. And then you start to get into the conversation of, well, can he kill penalties? Are his face-offs good enough? Like all the stuff we talk about sometimes with Neil Zaman. Sasson doesn't have the speed, obviously, that an Amon does, but I do think he's got some tenacity and creativity to his game. And again, you know, you put up 0.7 points per game in the American League, like that tends to be not a hard and fast rule, but that's like a pretty powerful if rudimentary demarcation line between guy who could actually have like top nine upside versus guy who won't, especially when you're doing it in your early 20s. You know, it's one of my concerns about Podkolzin, like 0.64 in the American League, albeit at a younger age. You know, that worries me. Like Sasson clears that bar. So that to me makes him certainly intriguing. More likely is like an injury call-up option, I'd think, if he has like a really good summer, impresses at camp, isn't among the first cuts, and then is an option to come up next year. I think that's, you know, that represents like progress for him. But I do think you're right to bring him up given Lindholm, Bluger being out of contract here, right? I mean, Vancouver's center depth emerged as a real strength of this team, like an elite aspect of this team was the ability to go Miller, Pettersson, Bluger, Lindholm down the middle. And, you know, it was never tested, but even the depth there where it's like, and then Suter if necessary, and then Amon if necessary, right? I mean, that was like a core of steel that this club was able to fall back on in controlling play and in playing suffocating defense throughout last year. You know, with Bluger and Lindholm out of contract, and I think the organization is going to prioritize keeping one of them, but nonetheless, that does alter that dynamic. And I think it's a dynamic. It's such an interesting spot that the Canucks find themselves in because they need to get better, but they also need to be protective of what made them who they were this year, which, you know, really was that ability to control play 5-on-5 and limit opponents. I mean, that's the ball game, and that requires a lot of expenditure on your defense and on your centers. As much as we're talking about
scoring winners, you know, and
the winger question. And I don't think we're wrong to talk about the winger question. It's just that it's not as simple as going out and adding one winger and, you know, dusting off your hands. It's like, how do you fit Hronek's next deal in, you know, come to terms with Myers if that's what you're doing, you know, and then find a way to replace Zadorov if you can't come to terms with him and it's going to be hard to, and replace what Ian Cole brought. Wow, that was a good Freudian slip. Replace what Ian Cole brought, you know, and then also, you know, make sure that your center depth remains the strength of the team. And then also add a game breaker top six. There's a lot of sort of spinning plates here, which I think is partly why taking stock of what the club has internally, like it's a good thing to do as sort of like a baseline calm before the storm. Because when you really add in, you know, the team's success, how that raises the stakes for next season, the fact that so many major contributors to that success are out of contract, and the fact that the club actually has cap flexibility. I mean, that is just a recipe for churn. That's a recipe for uncertainty, and not in a bad way, right? Like just a recipe for change. And with change, right, comes opportunity for some of these younger players.
And, you know, you bring up the center side of the equation for Max Sasson, and somebody texted in, can you guys talk about Dom Lucision's article analyzing all of the UFA centers, or at least some of the top UFA centers? And again, this is up at The Athletic today. And, you know, without going into it in exhaustive detail, one of the things that stood out to me is one of the only guys that Dom kind of highlights as a potential value option or someone the team should be interested in as kind of a guy who can offer surplus value is Teddy Bluger, right? Like kind of a, hey, if you miss out on the big name guys, don't be afraid of going after Teddy Bluger because the model likes him a decent amount. Now, is he going to get more than the $1.8 million that the model projects him? Yeah, quite possibly. But there's still room there to pay Teddy Bluger and have a pretty decent contract on your hands. And I think given the relative lack of options in the system, given how important, as you said, the center depth was for the Canucks this past season, given the likelihood that Elias Lindholm is going to be too expensive to retain and it won't really make sense for the Canucks to retain him. I mean, we've done so much talking about, okay, who are the priorities for the Canucks to keep going into this summer, you know, Hronek and Zadorov and Joshua, but because it's a center, it's a premium position, his contract might not be that onerous. Like, I think you could make a good case to have Teddy Bluger pretty high on that list as well, given how important the center position was to his team last year.
Yeah, I think so too. And yet it's such a tough one, man. There's so few centermen.
Yeah.
No, really. Teddy Bluger is one of the ones that I struggle with probably the most from a, there's a right thing to do, because I'm not sure there is. Like, I'm not sure there's a right answer necessarily here. I mean, Bluger is one of a very short list of 25 plus point UFA centermen available this summer, right? Like, it's literally Bluger, Wennberg, Roslovic, who had his best success this season on the wing.
Yep.
Right? Lindholm, who's going to be $1 million. Max Domi, who's not good defensively. I'll stand by that. Sean Monahan, who's, you know, 29 and has a lengthy history of injuries and who the Canucks haven't previously been interested in, and Chandler Stephenson, who does his best work on the wing.
Yeah.
You know, or as a center, but with Mark Stone. So, you know, I think the options are so limited, and yet, you know, they felt that way last year too. And the Canucks were able to pick Teddy Bluger off of, you know, a lengthy run with Vegas where he was mostly a healthy scratch and was really valued around the league as like a true fourth liner. You know, there are names, like there are, whether it's Stenland, we've seen Sam Carrick play pretty well in this playoffs for the Oilers, Colin Blackwell, you know, are they as good as Bluger? No. But that's kind of the point. Like, yeah. Neither was Bluger, right? When they signed him and it worked out as well as it did. You know, I just like sort of think through it and see names like Travis Boyd, names like Pierre-Edouard Belmar, you know, and it strikes me that while I don't think the club should feel comfortable moving forward without Bluger or Lindholm, like retaining neither, you know, you do have Pugh Suter, right?
Yes.
Like, you do have Pugh Suter. There are more wingers available. I think there are other routes to sort of get there without breaking the bank while sort of committing your resources mostly to, honestly, like higher up the lineup spots, right? Like upgrading the defense, not just reconstructing the defense and extending Hronek, but like upgrading the defense, upgrading for sure your wingers at the top of the lineup. Like, at the end of the day, I'd rather see this club acquire an additional top six winger, or ideally top line winger, and move Pugh Suter to third line center than I would see them expend a ton of money, you know, retaining Bluger on like a 4-year times $2.5 million deal when, you know, a Travis Boyd's going to be available for, you know, probably league minimum, right? Where Pierre-Edouard Belmar is going to be available for probably league minimum and just has to relocate up the I-5. I like Bluger better than those options, don't get me wrong, but I think you have to factor in opportunity cost and all the various spinning plates that Patrick Alvin, Chef Alvin, is spinning in the kitchen at the moment, and be pretty ruthless in sort of how you evaluate what this club should and can afford to do here. What I would say is, even if you do go into next season with Suter down the middle, it's like you're going to probably want to bring in a righty faceoff winner ahead of the playoffs, regardless.
I think the Suter thing, you're right, it looms large, right? Because you have that option. So it's not as if you're going to be completely hooped if Bluger walks and you're like, oh my goodness, what are we going to do for a third line center? You have a viable option on the roster under contract already. But I do think, like, even if you say, okay, we're gonna reallocate those resources away from Teddy Bluger to other places in the lineup, which is a totally defensible decision. You know, last summer they did it with Bluger and Pugh Suter, right? They got the two budget options down the middle. And I think you probably want to be trying a similar approach, right? Can you get a budget option then to be your fourth line or maybe a fringe third line guy behind Suter? Can you get another guy like a Pugh Suter who, you know, can play center but also has value on the wing for you? Because I think you're going to want to try to reestablish some of that depth. I don't think it can be, you know, Miller, Pettersson, Suter, Amon, and then your AHL guys. Like, that's leaving it way too thin at center at such a crucial position.
Yeah.
So you got to, you can move Suter to third line center, but then you still have to go bargain hunting for a couple of options, probably.
For sure. And you know, throw in Max Sasson and, you know, see if you can make yourself, maybe it's not a stew, maybe it's a soup, maybe it's a thin soup, maybe it's tomato soup, and there's not even noodles or chicken or anything in it. But, like, you can still have yourself something, you know, warm for that cold night in November when you need some center options just to get you through.
And the winger, the star winger, then, is like the sweet grilled cheese on the side to complement. You see what,
like,
I mean?
And, like, some of the wingers have, like, bacon and tomato, you know? It's really good sourdough.
Some nice tomato jam. Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about it.
Oh, let's go.
And you can get by. Then you're perfectly fine with just some tomato soup if you've got the grilled cheese to complement it like that. All right. On that note, we will wrap up today. Thanks for listening. Thanks for texting in. We will be back, a special crossover edition, as always, on a Wednesday with our pals Donnie and Dolly from Czech TV. So make sure you tune into that. And boy, we will keep just waiting for the Stanley Cup final to get going, as it will on the weekend. I'm sure we'll continue to dive into every possible way to preview that one as well. So make sure you tune in tomorrow. Before that, keep it right here on Sportsnet 650.